This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 131 was recorded on September 6th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Natural resources guru Marin Katusa returns as this week's feature interview guest, and Marin gave us a fantastic interview this week. We're going to focus on uranium, why Marin thinks right now is a decadal setup for investing in it, and why the best investment plays are actually in North America. Particularly, we're going to talk about how accredited investors can use private placements to get in this game early, and quite a number of other topics. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when we'll give you an update on both the videos from Macro Voices Live Toronto, which so many of you are waiting for, as well as our efforts to organize another Macro Voices Live event this winter, as well as some reflections from Patrick and myself on JP Morgan head strategist Marco Kolonovic's recent piece describing what the next crisis might actually look like.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 last week almost cleared the 2920 level on the upside. And pretty much since our last podcast has been retracing lower. We printed temporarily below 2870, and as we record, are trading around this 2882 level on the S&P 500. What's your thinking here on the markets? Was that an important top in your mind?
Well, my very strong conviction here is right here, right now, it's time to, drum roll please, pay close attention. Because the first week of September is often when the direction of markets change. It's when the most influential decision makers are back from the Hamptons on the desk and things really start to get going in September. Now, in many ways, what we're seeing in terms of tape action so far has started to kind of follow that pattern of an August top, then September is when the volatility picks up, and if things are really going to get bad, the shit hits the fan in October, and you see a market crash. So in some ways, that pattern is starting to play out, at least the beginnings of it, but it's way too early to tell, in my opinion. This could easily be a head fake. It's not at all uncommon if those guys are coming back from the Hamptons saying, hey, it's time to buy, buy, buy. We really want to increase our equity positions. It would make perfect sense for them to intentionally engineer a head fake to the downside to take advantage of all of the anticipation and all of the people that are predicting that downside. Now, our longtime listeners know that I think it is way past overdue for this bull market to be over, but these things tend to fake you out. And I think at this point, it's time to watch very closely. So far, the sell-off that we've seen and the lows that we hit today do not, to me, say, okay, there's a crisis on. It looks to me like a perfectly normal pullback and probably an opportunity that should entice the dip buyers. I'm very curious to know what your thoughts are on this level that we're at and what we saw in terms of where the market bottomed. But frankly, Patrick, from what I see, looks to me like we had a pullback, a sell-off, and, you know, right now looks like the dip buyers, at least late on Thursday afternoon, are coming back to the table. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's going to stay that way, but for now, I don't see reason to panic and think that the market is crashing or it's time to go short here. I think it's time to watch very closely. What do you think?
Well, you know, the highs that came in on the S&P 500 came at an important technical move on the upside. We were looking for this retracement to actually kick in. And to be honest, a solid 40-50 S&P point pullback here is just a very natural retracement. We haven't seen technical damage yet done to the marketplace. But this is definitely now after 4 or 5 days of selling and this deep of a pullback, this is really where in the past the buy on dip traders would show up. I think the next 48 hours of trading is going to be so very important, because if we see that the buy and dip traders show up here and defend these levels anywhere around this 2870 level on the S&P, then there's still the window open for another full leg higher on the upside of the S&P. S&P. But boy, if the buy on dip traders don't show up here and we start breaking some key technical levels, things could get pretty hairy here quickly, but we haven't seen that yet. So you can't jump into the conclusion that that has begun. Just like you're saying, we have to just pay attention here. This is a very important crossroad. Otherwise, Eric, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index here. And the U.S. dollar hovering around this 95 level. We saw, obviously, that breakout that up toward 97 didn't hold, but this pullback here was just throwing back the breakout. But right here, we continue to consolidate. Emerging market currencies continue to be extraordinary. Weak, and really it's just the euro that's pinning this dollar index around this level. Is your bias still to the upside here on the dollar?
My bias is to the upside, and again, we are back above 95 on the dollar index, which is super important to the bullish thesis. As you said, the reason that we got pulled below it was not that the dollar systemically was starting to tank. It was because the euro, which makes up a very large percentage of the overall weighting of the dollar index, was showing some real bullish action. Meanwhile, the dollar was still appreciating against other emerging market currencies around the world. At this point, as we're speaking late Thursday afternoon before the close, we taped a little bit early today, we're hovering right at 95. We'll be close above it or below it. We'll see what happens today. But my view is still dollar bullish, not because I think the economy is wonderful and everything's great. It's more of the Jeff Snyder squeeze scenario that I think is on. Daily closes below 95 are reason to take pause in that view, and below 94 is reason for serious concern. But until that happens, I think higher is in the cards.
Eric, the last month has saw a test of the 64 kind of handle on WTI, and now we've seen a retracement in oil move all the way back to the 70-72 level and a very decisive turn lower off here. It feels very toppy here to me, and it's rolling over. What's your general feeling here on oil? Do you think that this is a bigger topping formation, or what's going on here?
Yeah, it does feel like a topping formation here. What we saw this week as far as inventory, crude oil drawing down 4.3 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, on the other hand, this is very refreshing. Even in the face of those big drawdowns nationally, Cushing is building 631,000 barrels, which is a really good thing because Cushing was hurting for storage capacity. Gasoline building 1 million barrels, distillates building 1.8 million barrels. Normally, you would expect that big 4.3 million barrel drawdown to be super bullish. I think some people were expecting an even bigger drawdown. And Patrick, I want to admit, I have been extremely busy today since that data came out. Of course, it was delayed by a day because of the holiday. So we got our EIA data on Thursday instead of Wednesday this week. The fact that we saw such a big drawdown and the price moved down rather than up suggests there's probably more information that I don't have yet. And I admit I've not been watching the oil market today, so I don't know what it is. But in general, bigger picture, we saw that move up all the way to almost 71.50 on WTI. A lot of that was driven, I think, by anticipation of a potential tropical storm disaster in the Gulf. Once those fears abated, it's been pretty much straight downhill since then, and it does feel like a topping formation. I do think that if we get a significant sell-off, if we were to break below that 64 level, let's say we get down into the, you know, $50 range, I think that that is going to be a really fantastic buying opportunity. I think that we're at the point where the shale revolution is not completely played out, but the opportunity for there to be massive new increases in shale production is really not there. I think we are headed toward higher oil prices in coming years. But in the next 6 months, I will be surprised if we don't get a sell-off to lower levels. And when that occurs, I think it's a buying opportunity. So as far as what happens next, I don't really have a firm directional view right now, other than I agree it is a topping formation. At least it feels like one.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold tested, obviously, around the 1170 level back in the middle of August. Since then, we bounced all the way back to about 1220 on gold, and now we're hovering just a few dollars above the 1200 handle. It's been a sideways consolidation in gold, but what's interesting as an observation is the gold miners continue to press lower. It's almost like a little bit of a divergence from what we're seeing in the equity markets on the gold miner side versus where bullion is. I don't know whether that's is a leading indicator or not. But right now, at least gold is hovering here sideways. What's your thinking here? Is this still just a pure play on the dollar in your mind?
I think it is a dollar play. I had a chance. We didn't get into gold with Marin Katusa, who is an authority on the subject in this particular interview. But I talked to him off the air, and he agreed with me that there's a good chance that gold moves lower from here as the dollar strengthens. We saw that bounce off 1167 in August, got up to 1220, seemed to run out of steam there. Looked to me like it was selling off pretty decisively. We've seen some strength in the last day or so, but even that has retraced. We're back down to 1205. As we're speaking here on Thursday afternoon. Again, the real question, the wild card is, if the rally in the dollar were to reverse and we saw the dollar close below 94 on the dollar index, that would really make me question whether I've had the wrong read on this market. But unless and until that happens, I think it's dollar higher, gold lower. Now, to be sure, gold is going to have its day in the sun. If you look at the much bigger macro picture and step out to a much longer time horizon, everything is expensive. Stocks are expensive. Bonds are more expensive. European sovereign bonds are even more expensive than that. What's left that's not ridiculously overpriced in this crazy market environment that we live in the end of 2018? Well, the answer is commodities and gold in particular. But I don't think it's over yet, Patrick. I think that there may be a flush out coming. I wouldn't be surprised if we got all the way down to $1,000 on gold. When we start getting to, you know, three-digit gold prices, that's where I think it's really time to start buying from a value perspective. But I don't think we're there yet in terms of the sell-off being over. I could be wrong, and the telltale that would tell me I am wrong is if we see the dollar close below 94 and stay there for several days.
You know, Eric, what I encourage actually all of our listeners to do is in the research roundup, I actually included a Jesse Felder blog article where he's trying to build a bullish case on gold. So it's a really interesting read. I encourage all of our listeners to have a read. Nonetheless, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yield, which continues to hover around this 288 handle, sort of stuck in the mud as well. No big decisive breakout in yields here. It feels like a big sideways consolidation that is winding up for a break. But is that break higher or lower? I mean, we have so many guests that have such variant ideas as to where this is going. What's your thinking?
Well, my strongest conviction here is the same thing I said on the equity market. Right here, right now, right after Labor Day, it is time to pay close attention and don't take your eye off the 10-year yield. It's really important to see what happens next. What's that something going to be? I have no clue, Patrick. The key levels to watch were in this narrow range between 280 and 3 even on the 10-year yield. The wider range, which I think is the more important one, is between 2 spot 60 and 3 spot 10. If we see breakouts past those levels, it's time to really take note, because it's been how many months that we've been consolidating in this 2 spot 80 to 3 spot 0 range? A long time. And the old saying, the longer you base, the higher in space, the bigger the move is likely to be when we finally break out of that consolidation. I really don't have any strong conviction in terms of which direction it's going to go. I think that which way bonds go, which way stocks go from here, it's after Labor Day. The big boys are back from the Hamptons. It's time to watch the market very carefully and let the market tell us what's happening, as opposed to us thinking arrogantly that we're smart enough to know better than the market does.
Well, thanks, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is author Marin Katusa, founder of Katusa Research. Eric's interview with Marin Katusa is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Marin Katusa, founder of Katusa Resources. Marin, we're so excited to get you back on the program. You had some killer calls for us last time. Now, we had a chance to speak off the air. We did a lot of talking about copper and the long-term argument for copper. We did mention uranium in the last interview, but I want to focus on uranium this time around. So let's start with the high-level macro perspective. Why uranium, and why uranium right now, when so many people in the world are convinced that, you know, nuclear energy will never be used again?
So Wouldn't it be interesting if the actual winner of the decarbonization of the planet was nuclear? And especially after what we've seen with Fukushima and the capital costs of building these nuclear reactors in the U.S. So what I actually did was I wrote a research report. Now, look, you know, I have the advantage of been to every single operating U.S. and Canadian mine. I've been to projects, and I've got a 17-year advantage over most people. So rather than writing a bullish case on uranium, I decided to challenge it and say, if I was a shorter, how could I write a short report on uranium using all the information available? And I went through every plant on the planet, all of the producers, how much each plant will use, and actually wrote a short report that I published for my subscribers. It was a very deep plus 20-page report. And at the end, I said, okay, let's look at the worst-case scenario because I'm going to ignore the base case and the positive case. And if we took off every unfinanced plant, first of all, let's talk about the emerging markets. If you take all of the planned and permitted plants, unless they're financed, I knocked them off the list and said they're not going to be built. And let's take all of the existing plants that have a potential phase-out. I knocked them all out, assuming they're going to be phased out. But not all of them are, remember that. But let's take the absolute worst-case scenario. You basically have a 10% reduction in uranium by 2030. That's the absolute worst-case scenario. So knock off 16 million pounds, right? The world uses about 168 million pounds a year. So looking at that, going, okay, you know, what do we actually produce? Well, America produces less than 2.5 million pounds last year, yet in the 60s it produced 35 million pounds. But what's the cost? What about the mines shutting down, such as MacArthur River, which is the second largest mine in the world? And you'd say, okay, yeah, but Marin, it wasn't economic. Well, when it's the second lowest cost producer outside of Kazakhstan, that might make you think about, that's interesting. And we're talking about the equivalent. Imagine you shut down a gold mine that runs 12 ounces per ton. 12 ounces, not 12 grams. This is tens of thousands of dollars of rock, the value there. So you look at what's going on in the market globally, and then you start realizing the emerging markets. Let's look at what's going on in China. They're actually building these and financing them themselves rather than the way it's going in North America. And they don't have the capital explosions from the union side that America's experienced. You look at what's going on in UAE, they just completed three new reactors. Same thing. So what about Fukushima's effect? Well, the Japanese are also moving forward with slowly bringing on their reactors. But in my report, I assume they'd all stay off. That's another key factor. So what about Germany? Well, Germany's Germany. Okay, they've got their own issues. I've also stated that those, in my report, in the worst-case scenario, would all stay down. But yet Germany today does import nuclear power from France across the river, assuming that there would be no fallout. That's just an absurd case in itself. So really, where does the makeup difference? The reality is now that because of what's happened in Fukushima, it's taken many, many years for the secondary supplies to be washed out into the market, Eric. And the key factor here is who's the gorilla, who's the center of the chessboard, and whether people like it or not or even understand it or not, it's the Kazakhs. And with their production, you know, they have about 60 million pounds a year of production, mainly from ISR, and they're now themselves saying, wait a second, we're not going to be selling into the spot market anymore. They've done very strategic alliances with the Western world. There's a fund, Yellow Cake, out of London, another one out of Vancouver. And what they're doing is they're strategically aligning themselves with the same type of, rather than the traders, the uranium traders who are just looking to play the R between the utility and the producer, they're now putting it towards holding funds. So the game really has started changing. You know, uranium is up over 15% year to date. It's a very contrarian play. Most fund managers believe that they put it in the coal sector, that the cost of building a nuclear reactor is too expensive. And in some parts of the world, definitely it is, if you have to pay huge union fees and permitting fees and all that. But in other parts of the world where that isn't the case, and you have a government initiative, the actual operating cost of uranium, the metal, in a nuclear reactor is less than 5%. Whereas you look at coal or or natural gas makes up over a third. So I look at it as the ultimate contrarian bet, but you got to be very careful too. There's a lot of junk out there. And I think if you're smart and you do your due diligence and invest in areas where the publicly traded companies can actually execute their business plan, and there's actually not that many regions that it can, there's certain areas that you have to compete with the Chinese and Russian influences. And here's the reality. They don't follow the same rules as the publicly traded companies. So don't make that bet. You're going to lose. The governments will always win on that side when it comes to geopolitical advantages. Mongolia was a great example. There was a company back in the day called Khan Resources. And the Russian company basically got what they wanted out of it, and the shareholders got nothing. That's one specific example, and I know many of those, so be very careful. But long term, I think we're in the beginning of a massive run that is going to be very comparable of the 2004 to 2007 run in uranium. That was the last time that I've seen this type of setup that we have right now.
Now, I couldn't agree more on the fundamentals, which is I think the world needs nuclear power. Everybody's freaked out over Fukushima, but at the end of the day, we need nuclear power. We're going to have demand for this. The thing, I'm so glad you mentioned Kazakhstan. The reason I would be nervous about investing in uranium right now is I know that a lot of it, most of it, is mined in places like Kazakhstan. And if I look at overall around the world, how much geopolitical instability there is, how much risk there is of losing your investment. You know, you mentioned Mongolia, Kazakhstan. These are not the most politically stable places. So how do you justify making an investment in these really remote jurisdictions where potentially an investment could be at risk if the whole country, you know, falls apart and doesn't honor its external commitments?
Well, I don't. Like, why do you need to? You don't need to go to Niger. There's an area called the Arlet Basin, essentially Arriva, the old French. Now they have a new name, but anyways, you know, at one point the French were getting over 70% of their baseload power from nuclear energy, and they were vertically integrated from the mines to the nuclear reactors. And they were getting a big portion of their nuclear source feed, the uranium, the yellow cake, from the Arlet Basin. But there's been a lot of issues, let's call it, in Niger. A lot of people won't say that, but why would I go? I've been there. I've been there and done that when I was a lot younger, Eric. I don't need to pop on the body armor anymore. It looks cool for promotional purposes and all that stuff, but I don't. I have a family now. I've made my money. I don't need to do that crazy shit anymore. So what I look at now is, why do I have to put my money there? I can go up to Saskatchewan, or I can go down to Texas, and I can get way better returns, much better deposits. Why do I need to go to Mongolia? Which, truth be told, Mongolia has great world-class uranium deposits, but so does Canada, so does U.S. At least there's a rule of law there. Why do I need to go to Niger or Namibia or Mongolia? You don't have to.
Well, let's focus on those markets then. You gave us a fantastic call last time we had you on the program for Nevsun. Do you have a favorite pick or a company that people should be looking at in the uranium space right now?
I do. Like, you know, going back to the Nevsun piece, our subscribers did really well. We closed out the position. But Serbia was very misunderstood. It was part of, I speak Serbian, so I had a little bit of an advantage there over most market participants. But people saw it as a backwards country. Many would probably compare it to a Stan country, and I thought that's ridiculous. And it fits the whole China One Road, One Belt road. A lot of people don't realize, but Serbia actually fits in part of that plan. Today, what I would look at in for me, in where I'm personally putting millions of dollars in, is going, wait a second. This uranium cycle has had a massive washout, and there's very few management teams that know what they're doing. So right off the bat, you're at a huge advantage. If you just spend, let's say, a week of due diligence, you can kind of figure out which management teams are who's who in the zoo right off the bat. Pull up their insider holdings, figure out what their cost base is. That's a starting point. Then work backwards and say, sorry, like Mongolia, Niger, Namibia, not really my thing. Gabon, you know, certain areas of Africa I love. There's other areas I have zero interest in site visits. And a lot of my colleagues, some of my former partners, are very bullish on pounds in the ground that, you know, when uranium gets to $80, this stock's going to go from 10 cents to $5. True, but there's easier ways to play it, in my opinion, where you can build upon politically stable jurisdictions. I call them non-AK-47 regions, and I call that because I've been to so many areas where we've had whether the former French Foreign Legionnaires putting on body armor, and we have literally driving in bulletproof vests to get to a well site or a project. And I just don't want to do that because I really believe the world has changed in the last 10, 15 years. For myself, you want to be in the Athabasca Basin, which is in Saskatchewan in Canada. But even there, you have to ask yourself, okay, am I buying exploration, development, or production? If you're looking at development, ask yourself, what's the cost of building a mine? That's one thing. But if I do build the mine, where do I send my product? And this is the biggest mistake in Canada. A lot of investors ask themselves, well, my company's going to build the mill. Well, it's not like a copper mill. This isn't a concentrator that you build up in the open air. This is a concentrator of radioactive material. So if your mine costs you, say, $300-400 million to build, a 20 million pound a year mill would cost you at least $1.5 to $2 billion plus a 10-year permitting window. So ask yourself, what am I getting into? I think for investors, Cameco is a place to start, but I think there's places as politically stable that you can do better in. And then I'd also look in the U.S. I believe, and I wrote about this years ago, that we will see uranium priced as Russian-sourced or former Soviet Union. You know how there's different prices for oil? Why do we not have that for uranium? Now, I understand, trust me, I wrote a book about this stuff, so I understand the different aspects, the chemical composition of the different types of oil between API and the different sulfur levels. But if you actually think about this, why wouldn't the U.S. have their own price for uranium domestically sourced versus importing it from a stance? You know, why is Trump not talking about tariffs on that aspect? Because that alone, people forget that America imports 95% of the uranium it consumes in the ground and their reactors, and half of that comes from Russia and Kazakhstan, two former Soviet states. So I sit there and go, wait a second, that's cannibalized the imports from the former Soviet Union, plus the DOE sales. A lot of people forget that the DOE was selling about 7.5 million pounds a year into American utilities at a cost lower than what the U.S. miners could produce it for. And those two factors, and you see uranium come pop up to $40-45. Do I see uranium going to 80 to 100? Not in the next couple of years. Could I see it going to $40? No problem. So how do I make a double or a triple or a quadruple? Well, you're not going to do it on a early stage company that has, you know, $2 million in the bank looking or pounds in the ground in Africa, not at $40 uranium. That stuff needs $80 uranium before the market gets excited. Look for what I call the easy plays. And I believe they're in the U.S. and Canada, and strictly think about how about taking the advantage or the mathematical advantage of royalties. Eric, not to bore your audience, but you know, if you look at, there's a little over 600 producing gold mines in the world, over 100,000 ounces a year. Over half of them have royalties on them, of some form of a royalty or stream. About 5% of the producing uranium mines in the world have a stream or royalty. I think the best place to put your money is in a uranium royalty company, and there's literally just one of them. And that's a huge advantage, and that's where I've put my big bet in the uranium market.
Marin, I want to come back and get the name of the company that you're looking at in just a second, but for the benefit of our many listeners who are macro-oriented and may not be familiar with the streaming model, let me make sure that I understand it. We're talking about the model where a company, I know this was pioneered in silver, you'd go to a gold mine that doesn't care about the silver and you'd say, hey guys, we want to buy out the rights to the silver that you end up mining as a byproduct of the gold that you're actually looking for when you build your mine. We're going to buy up those rights because you don't care about the silver. And as it actually tends to work out in reality, at least what happened last time was the price of silver went up, and a lot of those rights that had been sold off ended up getting bought back. And the people who had bought up the rights never had to build a mine. They never had to do anything. They had locked up the rights to the silver that was coming out of other kinds of mines. And eventually, when the silver became more valuable, they were able to sell those rights back. Is that what we're talking about here in this model? And if so, where's the uranium play? How does that fit in?
in that specific structure, everything in mining, it comes down to one thing, cost of capital. I've been involved in raising billions of dollars in this industry. I'm probably one of the largest financiers in the industry. And you can go to a mine and say, okay, what types of ways there to raise money? Well, you can issue equity, which means they do a financing to someone like me and they dilute themselves, or they can bring in a joint venture partner at the project level, or they can take on debt from a traditional bank, which right now the best project will be anywhere between 6 to 8% with the traditional banks. But if you go to the secondary lending markets, it's realistically between 12 and 14% interest after all the due diligence. Or there's the streaming and royalty concept. And because the royalty companies trade at a premium to their NAV, their cost of capital is lower than what a miner who trades at a discount to NAV, right? So there's a mathematical arb there. And they come and say, okay, Eric, you've got this uranium mine, and you're about to produce or you're producing, but you need a little bit more money, say $50 million. How about I'm going to take a stream on this, and every year you give me 500,000 pounds at $25 a pound, and we fix that price. So when the streaming companies did it, they did it at a slight discount. When you gave that silver example, today it's called Wheaton Precious Metals or Franco-Nevada. When Silver Wheaton started that model, they saw silver go from $4 an ounce to $40 an ounce, and they collect that right, or what you call that option, at $4. And in the uranium game, there's no royalty companies. And now you can get your life of mine stream on that production where you can either get the delivery of the uranium or, like you said, the mathematical option, and it's just a financial arb on that. And I believe right now the lowest cost producers in the world don't turn a profit at $30 a pound. They just don't. Whether you're in Kazakhstan or Cameco, the two largest producers, neither of them are covering their cost of capital at $30 a pound. It's going to readjust. I think we see $40 within 12 months, and you get the biggest bang on your buck from the streamers because of your cost of capital. But if I was to go build a mine, the permitting process, it takes years. So you bypass all of the operational risk, execution risk, permitting risk, development risk, financing risk with the streamers. You just cut your deal. That's why I love the streaming model.
So let me summarize that and make sure I've got it straight. What we're talking about is you can see this opportunity in uranium. You look at any realistic evaluation of what it would take to get into this business yourself, and it's overwhelming. So instead, you look for who are the smartest guys that are doing the best job that are already in business, and you go to them and you say, look, you're selling uranium for $30 a pound. I want to buy lots and lots of it for $30 a pound for the next several years. And to the seller, it seems like the guy wants to pay the asking price for many years. It's a great customer. And in reality, what that guy's doing is he's getting a free call option. He's basically locking in today's price, and when tomorrow's price is much higher, he's still locked in what is going to end up later on being a bargain basement price. Is that the gist of it?
Except we do it at a discount to the spot, not at spot. So, correct.
So instead of paying a premium for that call option, you're actually buying a call option that's in the money already, and you're getting a discount on the premium. And you're doing that because you're providing needed capital to that seller that's, you know, very excited about their business model. But everybody, it makes the same mistake in mining, which is they don't plan their capital. They're all running out of money. And you're the savior coming in on the white horse saying, we've got money for people who are willing to give us a bargain. And you end up buying those bargain rights. Now, I know in the silver case, the guys that had the bargain rights to the silver, they didn't even have to take the silver. They ended up selling the rights back at a windfall profit and didn't have to sell any silver. Does that apply in this case as well?
Well, you have that option, but as one of the largest shareholders of the company, I don't want them to do that yet because the valuation compound that you get when uranium gets to $40 to $45, and remember, that doesn't, like, pre-Fukushima, uranium was $75 a pound. Just in 2013, it was $40, $45 a pound. It was the washout that we've seen. You know, I just don't think that many new mines need to come into production. And I actually don't like exploration risk. Exploration is a very, very tough game. And I just want to clip the arb on the streaming model. And, you know, my good friend Pierre Lassonde became a very, very wealthy man running Franco Nevada through that exact model. But the setup for uranium is like doing Franco Nevada back in 1996 or, you know, Silver Wheaton in 2003. That's the setup right now for uranium.
Marin, I'm sure that a lot of listeners just queued in when you said that you're one of the biggest shareholders in a particular company that's engaged in this model. I should probably explain that out of respect to your paying newsletter subscribers, you're not at liberty right now to tell everyone what that is, but certainly that has been disclosed to everyone who subscribes to your newsletter. Is there anything else that you can tell us for people who are not subscribers with respect to this business model and where they can learn more about this general approach?
The streaming and the royalty model is well known. You can look at companies like Franco Nevada, Wheaton Precious, Royal Gold, and there's many in the oil patch also that do it. This is the first one in the uranium sector. There's going to be many, many imitators afterwards. Myself and my subscribers, we got in at the same price all through a financing. That's also something that we feature in my newsletter. There's open market buying, and then there's also the financing opportunities. I personally love buying my first two tranches through a financing because I don't have to spend all the time in the market getting my bids filled. It's just there's the price, there's how much I'm buying, and it's done. And with the financings, you also get the beautiful warrants sometimes, not always, but sometimes. So in my experience, after being over 500 projects, being in over 100 countries and all these different projects around the world, the best business model, now you'll never make the most money. The biggest gains are always in discoveries or buying discoveries when they're broken down, like what we did in Northern Dynasty a couple of years ago. You're never going to get a 20-bagger from a royalty company within the first couple of years. You got to hold it for 6 to 7 years to get something like that. But for a three-year hold, I believe in this uranium company, we'll make somewhere between 3 and 5 times our money. And you always have to ask yourself, Eric, what's my exit? How do I get out of these deals? And because there's no other royalty company on the planet doing this, and this company's already locking in royalties, well, the bigger royalty companies are going to realize this and buy them up with their cost of capital being lower than the uranium royalty company. Just like my whole thesis on what happened with Nevsun, and before that, we had a buyout with Altera, where I was the second largest shareholder, and that company got bought out by Energex. I believe the buyer for the uranium royalty company will be actually a larger royalty company rather than they don't know uranium royalties. They can't go and structure these deals. Uranium is such a niche market because, you know, these royalty companies are run by gold guys or accountants. So they have to go and get these uranium guys to understand the business, or they can just pay a fair price for someone who's already done it, especially when uranium's going higher and higher. That's our exit.
I want to stay on this topic because we have a very large accredited investor population in our listenership who I know is going to be interested in it. First of all, I think we've got a little bit of U.S.-Canada terminology. When you're talking about financings, I assume that what you mean in my terminology is private placements that are only available to accredited investors, buying companies before they go public.
Correct. Well, there's pre-IPOs, but then there's also companies that are public and also do either a long-form prospectus or a short-form. So we've done both. We've done pre-IPOs, so before the big money managers in New York or San Francisco or Toronto get access to it, our subscribers are in. But we've also done financings after the company's public and it's already listed and trading, and then you do a financing in the already listed company.
Now, this is very interesting to me because I know from talking to our mutual friend, Rick Rule, that there's a lot of fantastic opportunities for accredited investors in private placements in, let's say, junior gold mining companies. Well, the thing is, you're going to do a private placement in a junior gold company. You've really got to know a lot and know that you're taking a pretty big risk because you never know which way those things are going to go. If I understand you correctly, you're talking about private placements, but they're not in exploration companies. It's a private placement in a streaming business model where you're basically making your private placement investment in a company which is going to go and buy these discounted call options. It doesn't have to build any mine. It doesn't have any risk of turns out that they got kicked out of whatever stand they were in, any of that stuff. Am I correct? And I didn't know anybody was doing this. Your company has apparently done financings where you're offering your subscribers the opportunity, if they're accredited investors, to participate in a private placement in this streaming model company. Is that right?
Exactly. So how it worked is I did my whole research report and played out the whole short case for uranium, saying, you know, worst case scenario, here's the landscape, and how do we make money in this horrible market? And then I came to my conclusion, said the best way to do this is streaming. We could still make money in a horrible market, and if the uranium goes gonzo and goes to $45, $50, $60, I'm going to make even more money, which is great, but the upside always takes care of itself. Let's focus on the downside. And because I was personally writing a very large check and becoming one of the largest shareholders of this company, my subscribers have the right, after they read the research report, to call the company and get in at the same price as myself. The best part of what I do is I don't take any fees from these companies. I work for my subscribers. They pay me my annual fee, and there is no fees paid. So, you know, a lot of these financings, whether it's Rick or anything, Rick takes a finder's fee because he works at a brokerage firm, and that's what brokers do. They take a commission. This way, 100% of the money raised is going towards the streams. Whereas right now on the street, the average fee is probably like 7-8 points cash, 7-8 points in broker warrants. You're looking at like the cost of capital for these companies right off the bat. You're looking at 12 to 15 points. So maybe 85 cents on the dollar goes into the ground or wherever it's going usually. I love churning the industry upside down. And if you're accredited, now this, you have to be accredited to do this. I don't make the rules. I play by the rules. And that's what I love about the bear market in commodities, especially uranium, because there's really not many people doing it. Now, Rick is a very close friend of mine. We were partners in one of my funds. Rick's done many financings. Some of them we co-invest. Other ones, I wonder what he's doing, and we disagree, whatever. That's the beauty of the free market enterprise. But for myself, my big bet is take the low risk angle because you'll still do really well. And for myself, where I am in this phase of my career and for what I want to do with my newsletter, I'm happy with a 3-5 bagger over 3 to 5 years. I think that's a reasonable, you know, I don't want to be shooting for the 10 baggers because you have to have the support of the uranium market. Most of these junior exploration companies who are looking for uranium don't have uranium. They're looking for it. That's a very expensive venture. The cost of capital is expensive. And unless uranium gets really going, the market's not going to come to them, right? Meaning, you know, everything is based off of supply and demand. And unfortunately, these junior companies supply a lot more shares than there's a demand for them. And that's why they're not going anywhere. I like the cash flow model. I like going after producing assets and eliminating execution risk, development risk, permitting risk, jurisdictional risk, and just going into production. I just want to cut my stream. That's it. It's nice and easy. And Eric, some people might say, oh, geez, Marin's lost his edge on risk. No, I actually haven't. When the time's right, I take big risks. But I just think right now it's a very unique business model, and they have such an advantage, and they have about a 2-year runway lead over anyone else. And in 3 years, we'll relook at what's going on. But for now, I think it's the safest way to play the sector for maximum upside.
Marin, you touched on a point that's very important there, and I want to make sure we don't skip over it, which is warrants. Let's just make sure we explain this to our listeners. If you're buying a private placement, you're basically buying stock in a company that either hasn't gone publicly yet, or as you say, maybe it's a public company which is doing some kind of offering that is allowed to make a private placement of stock. Most people, if they're not initiated to this game, would think it's all about the price you pay for the stock. That's the only thing you'd care about. People who are veterans of this game will tell you that warrant rights are more important than the price you pay for the stock itself. Please explain that. What are we talking about? What's a warrant? How does it play into this story?
Okay, so a warrant usually comes with, you know, the earlier stage of the company, the financiers want to get paid for their risk. So what happens is it's called a unit. So let's use a great case called Northern Dynasty. Northern Dynasty is a company that had a big project called Pebble, and they needed to raise money. So I was the large financier in it, and we did a 45-cent financing. It was for a unit. So for 45 cents, you get a share and a warrant with an exercise price of 55 cents. So you pay 45 cents for the stock, and you have the right to a warrant. But you don't have to exercise it. Now, if the stock trades at 45 cents till the end of the expiration date, so a warrant, just like an option for management team, it expires. So there's as short as 12-month warrants, and in the specific case of Northern Dynasty, we had 5-year warrants, and it was a full warrant. So warrants can come as quarter warrants, half warrants, and the time frame could be anywhere from 12 months to 60 months. It could be 18, 24, 36, whatever the financiers negotiate with the company. But where the warrants really kick in, Eric, is in the Northern Dynasty case, is when the stock went to $4, you know, you made almost 10 times your money on the share, but on the warrant, you almost made 10 times. So you made 9 on the stock and 8 on the warrant. Now you pulled a 17 bagger. So you get paid almost twice when it works out. That's the beauty of warrants. Now, the best type of warrant is what Rick Rule calls the Catoosa warrant. He named it after me. Is what we did on the Northern Dynasty warrant is we actually listed the warrant and it trades like a stock and has a ticker WT, and that warrant trades. And now the beauty of these warrants is a lot of big funds and individuals can't buy stocks under, you know, a dollar because they're penny stocks or what, for whatever reason. For example, my partner Doug Casey phones me up and Morgan Stanley says, hey, you got to get rid of your this stock because it was 80 cents. And Doug paid whatever he did. Stock went under a dollar. And they don't want that on their books because it's a penny stock and it's just a liability for them for whatever reason. So long story short, these brokerage firms like Morgan Stanley or whoever it is doesn't want that risk. But a warrant is like an option. It's like a put or a call. And the funds, because it has an expiration date, can speculate in the warrants, and they can't actually speculate in the stock. So there was a period of time when Northern Dynasty was trading at, you know, $4, $4.50, the warrants actually traded at $4 a share. So that 45-cent unit, the shares at $4.50, and the warrants are trading a little above $4, that's $8.50 combined in your listed fee with a Catoosa warrant. Those are the type of potentials you can get in financings. Now, not all financings have warrants, but in a bear market, especially in exploration or development, you can get warrants. I've gotten warrants on producing mines, on producing oil companies. They're there if you know what you're doing.
So just to summarize, the scenario is you've got a company that wants to sell its shares to an accredited investor in a private placement. They're saying, hey, we think it's a fair value to pay 50 cents a share for our shares, and so please buy some. Accredited investor turns around and says, yeah, well, you know, it might be a fair value, but you need money, and I've got money, so I want a bargain. So I want you to give me what's effectively a free call option. I'm going to pay the 50 cents, the fair price for the stock, but I want you to give me a call option that lets me buy another share of stock for that same 50 cents for the next 2 or 3 years. And if the stock triples in price, all of a sudden, that option, which is called a warrant when it's issued by the company as opposed to someone else, ends up giving you as much profit potential as the stock itself did. Needless to say, very profitable model. Is that basically a summary of how this works?
Correct. And what I love about listing the warrants, and actually of all of the exchange, I've listed more, my financings, I've listed more warrants than anyone else in the industry. And, you know, growing up, Doug and Rick were mentors to me when I was working with them and partners with them. And the old saying would be, peel out the shares and ride the warrant. That's industry lingo. Well, I've turned that off upside down. And by listing the warrant, there's no overhang on the stock. So you can actually keep the share and peel out the warrant. It actually turned the whole financing upside down. So in growing up with Rick's mentorship, you do a, you know, 50 cent financing, you have a right for 75 cent option on the warrant exercise price, and the stock's at $1. Well, people would sell the shares and ride the warrant for a few more years. But what if you could actually not have that overhang of the warrants, sell the warrant, and you keep the share for free? It takes away the selling pressure off the issuer. That's why I love listing the warrants.
Let's switch gears now, because I want to come back to the recommendation you gave us last time I interviewed you on this program, which was for Nevsun. And at the time, I want to be clear with our listeners, the fact that that stock moved up 50% in something like 48 hours after you made that call, that was pure dumb luck. That part was not skill. But the fact that you knew to focus on a company that was going to be an acquisition target, that part was skill. And I think where Macro Voices listeners happened to get lucky and the call played out in the 48 hours, for the people who are reading your newsletter, it took more like 10 months. But waiting 10 months for a 50% payout is still an awfully good deal. So, you know, Marin, if you took seriously the stuff they teach in universities about efficient markets hypothesis and so forth, it's impossible to make a call like that. You do it consistently, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners would like to know how. And I'm sure your first answer is buy my newsletter, but for people who want to know how to do it themselves, what do you do in order to build an investment process to find companies that are going to be takeout targets, acquisition targets? Because that clearly is, particularly in natural resources, a very effective strategy.
For sure. Let me give you two examples at the same time. So when we talked about the Nevsun example, you know, I laid out my site visits, how I go do your due diligence, you understand your own models, but then you say, okay, what kind of product would they produce? And you got to kind of know what you're doing when you build your models. And before, you know, in my newsletter, I have my takeout candidates. I think this is a takeout target, and Nevsun was one of them. The one before that was a company called Altera Power. And the chairman of that company was the largest investor in the company. And him and I actually had a public feud in 2009 on the valuation of his company. It was trading at $25 a share at the time. And I was a moderator of this investment conference. And Lucas Lundin, another billionaire, sitting at the panel. Doug Casey was there. Rick Rule was also there, our mutual friend there. And someone in the audience goes, you know, Marin, you're the mathematician of the group. What's your opinion of this valuation? I said, I personally believe right now, this is videotaped, this is on the web, and I said, I believe the company is priced to perfection. I don't understand why you would buy it at $25 a share when they have to execute perfectly to justify that price. And that was September of 2009. By October 2014, obviously, I followed the industry. This is the industry I am, so all the press releases, conference calls, you do what you got to do, you update your models. And the stock went down to about $3.50. Remember, so 5 years later, it went from $25 to $3.50. You would think that the company was a disaster, right, Eric? No, they actually executed their business plan. They had better cash flows. They did everything they said they would do, but guess what? The industry sentiment changed. What happened during that time? SunEdison blew up. So I wrote up a report where David Einhorn went big on SunEdison, and I said, man, your numbers are wrong. This company's going to go bankrupt. What you should do is do what I'm doing. And I became the second largest shareholder of Altera Power, and I said to my subscribers, look at its true NAV on just operating. This company is cheap, and we told my subscribers under $5, buy it all day long, and I was the largest buyer of it, period, in the open market. Also, my subscribers got involved in a financing in it at $6 also. And I said, look, let's give its exploration and development projects zero value. And ironically, this company provided the geothermal fluid provided. It's a famous spot. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, called Blue Lagoon in Iceland. It's kind of like the country's hot spot. Kim Kardashian did a whole thing on it. Anyways, the company owned a third of it because they supply all of the geothermal fluids that provide the spa environment. No analyst even realized. I go, that alone is worth about $1.50 a share. That's getting zero value. Innergex, another large green energy company, bought it out for $8.25. And in our reports, we said, well, one of these five companies will buy it out because it fits into their portfolio. And you just got to do your homework. And it's when you buy. I spent the first 10 years of my career learning how to analyze and how to buy, or like what it takes, like what are the components of finding a good stock. Then I spent the second 10 years how to buy, and more importantly, when I'm buying, when I'm about to buy, what is my exit? Understanding what is the valuation I'm going to sell this. If my thesis is right and my analysis is right, what do I look at? When do I sell? So for the Nevsun example, I laid out my whole model. I had a candidate that I said would buy it in my report. You know, from the June 2017 report, I said, this is who I think should buy this, and here's why it fits. They have a mill in Portugal. It makes all sense in the world. And at 485, so we got about 67% gain on it. I sold it out, and my subscribers get 3 business days to sell before I sell. And at 485, I closed out my position. And granted, I sold maybe a little early. The Chinese company called Xinjin came and put an offer on top of the 475 offer at $6 a share. But I'm okay because my number said 485 was fair value. The Chinese were paying for potential other discoveries, and to secure the deal, they were willing to pay an extra $1.25. Hey, I can't get that upside, but I was happy with a 67% gain in a year, and I was a big shareholder. So that's kind of the process. You have to understand, what are you buying, when are you buying, and when do you sell? I'm trying to simplify it, but it takes a lot of work to do that. When I look at the uranium sector, there's going to be a lot of new companies. I remember in 2004 when I first started financing uranium companies, there was like 10 to 12 management teams that, you know, that's all there were. By 2007, we went from 12 companies to over 500 uranium companies. There's something about the resource sector. It attracts, it's like the bacteria growth. It attracts everybody with a dream in their eye. And there become, I remember there was European projects and everywhere in Europe and in Slovenia, people were trying to promote projects and the country banned. There's no way you're going to mine uranium there. But guys would create these companies. So you got to kind of go, wait a second, what am I doing here? Who are these guys? Does this project make sense? What's the infrastructure like? You know, what's the history? What's my political risk? And more importantly, if I'm right on my analysis, what's this thing worth and when do I sell? And never worry about getting the top, because in almost 20 years of doing this, Eric, I've never bought at the exact bottom and sold at the exact top. I might have gotten pretty close to the bottom and pretty close to the top, kind of like what I did with Nevsun. But like on Altera, I got pretty close to the bottom, but I didn't buy the exact bottom. And we sold when the company got bought out by Intergex. That's the best way to exit, when you know, is it fair value? Another major will come in and buy it out. And that's generally how you succeed in the cyclical junior resource sector.
Marin, I could pick your brain about this for the next 3 hours, but unfortunately, we are running out of time. Before we close, I want to quickly touch on your company's services. You manage a hedge fund. You returned 138% in 2016. That's after fees, net to investors. Another 58% in 2017. The only reason I can actually mention those performance numbers on the air is your fund is closed. So unfortunately, sorry, folks, doesn't matter if you're accredited. You can't get into that one, because you've already hit your AUM target, and it sounds like you're probably not going to reopen that to outside investors anytime soon. That leaves your newsletter service for people who want to do it themselves. Tell us a little bit more about who is it for, how is it structured, and for people who want to learn more about it, is it possible to get a free trial or a money-back guarantee or something? Because it's a very high-value newsletter, but it's not cheap. So how do we protect our listeners who might want to try it out? And let's face it, not everything is for everybody.
First of all, that's exactly right. I think if you're looking to spend, you know, invest at least $25,000 to $30,000 over the next 12 months into the resource sector, that's your starting point for my newsletter. I just write what I'm doing with my money. Here's my analysis. You get the same type of research that my fund shareholders have. Now, who's it for? It's for my mother, it's for my brothers, it's for my wife who's a geologist, it's for myself. This is what I'm doing for myself, for my net worth, for my family, for the people in my office. And I think as long as you want to work at, like I've got little, you know, cliches that I use in the newsletter, like the way of the alligator, you gotta be strategic on your buying and disciplined. You know, I don't have a new investment recommendation every month. We have less than 10 companies in the portfolio, but I have a watch list. I'll give you a great example on one of them. There's a royalty company. I did a whole royalty analysis of every single company about 5 months ago, Eric, and I said, look, I think the market's going down. Gold and silver are going lower. I believe these are trading at a significant premium to their NAV, their net asset value. And I think with the compression of commodity prices plus funds selling them, let's buy these below NAV. And then I charted the history of a company, and I showed how Royal Gold actually traded in December of 2015 below NAV. It traded at 0.9 NAV, and that was the lowest it ever traded. And we're actually approaching that, and I send out multiple alerts to my subscribers saying, hey, we're getting there, we're getting there. And I said this one specific company would drop 40%, we're almost there, and I keep telling my subscribers, be patient, buy your first tranche at this price. So I have a buying matrix. I tell people to buy your first 20% desired allocation at this price. Then we're going to wait and buy our next 25%. So you've got to do a little bit of work. This isn't like a glitzy, puffy, it's not a comic book. This is my portfolio. I take it very serious. Every issue I try to keep under 20 pages. I have not succeeded yet. Some of them are as long as 40 pages. I try to make it interesting. I try to make it fun. Now, you know, what can I provide? How about I do one better for any of your subscribers that want to just try it out? Try it out for 30 days. If you don't think it's the best newsletter in the industry for resources, just for resources, we'll give you all your money back. The 30-day money-back guarantee, you got nothing to lose. You get access to not just that month's issue, every single thing I've published since I've started. And Eric, I think people will find out why guys like Doug Casey, who's the chairman of a competitive newsletter to me, why I manage all his money. And what I'm trying to do is even the odds for the retail person, because I started out as a high school math teacher when I was 23 years old, and I wanted more out of it. What I'm trying to do with my newsletter is what I would want to subscribe to myself. It's that simple. My subscribers get 3 business days before I buy in the open market, and they get 3 business days before I sell. So they have the advantage over myself, but when it's a private placement, they get the same alert as myself, and they get the same price. But when we sell, they get 3 business days to sell. And people might ask, well, why the hell is this guy doing it? For one reason, incredible deal flow. You know, in university, when they say you publish or perish, well, because I publish so much, the industry follows, industry players follow my stuff. And, you know, it's kind of in the room, in the deal kind of thing. People remember me and they'll go, geez, we need Marinin on this deal. And I'll be invited to the site visit. And then in the hopes of me writing the company up. Now, 99% of the time I don't, but by publishing and being out there, I get access to the best deal flow. And that's why I do it.
Okay, Marin, so to summarize, this is for serious people that want to take natural resource investing seriously. This is not your beginning investor kind of thing. And let's face it, it's not cheap. It's a $3,500 per year subscription. Patrick Serezna, my amazing producer, has negotiated very hard with your staff. And once again, we've got a $19.99. I don't know what that is on a percentage basis off the top of my head, but a pretty steep discount. So it's just under $2,000 only if you're a Macro Voices subscriber. And listeners, you'll find the link in your Research Roundup email for that. The one hesitation that I have about this, Marin, is listening to your description. You say this is for you, this is for your family, this is your people. Those are all pretty successful people who are accredited investors. And I wonder, is there value here if you're talking almost entirely about things like private placements that are only available to accredited investors? Is there value for non-accredited investors? And if so, what form does that come in?
Well, the majority of what we do is not financing. So let's just make that clear. So on my list, about 1/3 of my subscribers are accredited and 2/3 are not. And remember, my parents were immigrants to Canada. I started with nothing. It wasn't like I was a silver spoon kid. So when I started, I was definitely not accredited. And 2/3 of my list, my goal is that eventually everyone on my list becomes accredited. And that's through our open market buying. And my strategy is when to buy. You know, I call it the way of the alligator. It's on my website. You kind of get that out. And that's why I stated, if you're just looking to invest anything less than $25,000 in in 12 months, it's not for you. If you're looking at saying, hey, I've got about 25 to 50 grand, this is definitely something that you should take me up on my 30-day offer. You got nothing to lose. And you can look at my style. It's a very, very different style than most newsletters, because in every one of these deals, I become one of the largest shareholders at the same price as my subscribers, whether it's Altera or Nevsun or, you know, this uranium royalty company. There's many ways that a investor can buy. And another strategy is even the accredited investors, you know, they might say, I'll buy a quarter of it in the financing, but I'll look at buy in the open market if it weakens up, or, you know what, the trend looks up, they might play the momentum on it. So there's many ways to play the newsletter. But most importantly, it's the research and the uniqueness in the industry, whether it's Rick or Doug or even my competitors. They'll all say, my stuff is unique. And, you know, I pride myself on being the first to the story, like being the first to publish on Altera, or being the first on Nevsun, being the first on the Uranium Royalty Company. These are what I strive for. It's what makes me want to come to work. Yeah, it's a lot of ego. I'm well aware of it, but I'm very proud of what I do, and I'm proud of the team I have. It's not just me. I've got a pretty impressive team in the Vancouver office. I have one of the world's most renowned condensate geologists, you know, petroleum guys, Dr. Mark Buston is one of my guys. Two Canadian Hall of Famers, Roman Schlenka and Jim O'Rourke. You know, they were both inducted into the Canadian Mining Hall of Fame. They work with me intimately in our office. Plus, I've got a whole team here. So it's not like it's just Marin plugging away. I've got a pretty sophisticated team, and when I don't know an answer, I try to figure out who does and go to them. So, you know, people might say, well, why don't you just publish this for free? I spend about $400,000 a year on just data services. And, you know, on one deal, I spent over $370,000 on just due diligence on stuff that I didn't know and my team didn't know. So I went to the best in the industry and paid them to do it. That stuff costs money. And, you know, my newsletter is for serious investors, and I priced it to basically eliminate the non-serious people.
Well, Marin, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. We ran a little bit over time on this one, but it was well worth it for fantastic content. I look forward to getting you back on the program soon. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Marin. It was great to have him back on the show. He truly is a subject matter expert. It's great to always get some of his insights. What was some of the things that you took away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, for sure, Marin is the real deal when it comes to natural resource investing. It's funny, I was joking with Marin off the air, you know, with no disrespect intended toward Marin. In the newsletter space, really, Marin's name is kind of a nobody. The guy in that space, which is has much, much wider name recognition, is Doug Casey. But Patrick, what does Doug Casey do with his own money? He has Marin manage it for him. And, you know, that really says it all to me. I really enjoy having him on the program, and particularly just getting into the way he thinks. Something that I learned from this, the idea of peeling off the stock and profiting from the warrants in private placement investing is something that I was familiar with. Marin's idea of turning that on its head by lobbying an exchange to list the warrants, because of course you have to worry about the expiration date on a warrant, so that you basically have the ability to cash out, recoup your original investment from the warrant, and then hang on to the stock as a free ride that you can hold indefinitely and allow it to profit, is absolutely brilliant. So I love the way that Marin thinks, and it's a pleasure to have him on the program.
You know, I'm so glad that he brought up warrants, because like exchange-traded options, which are a derivative of the underlying, these warrants give the owner the right to be able to buy the underlying at an agreed-upon price over a given period of time. So from an option pricing perspective, they share very similar characteristics in terms of pricing, with small nuances like gearing in the pricing. But generally, it's a great vehicle from which to express the upside of a stock, and you can do so. What's interesting, the one little difference is that a lot of warrants are much longer in duration. Like in the options market, we could buy these 3 month and 6 month options, and then in the leap market, we can go out 1 and 2 years in duration. But many of these warrants are even like 5 years or more in duration. So they're like these long dated leaps that you can do on these exploration companies. Now, nonetheless, I wanted to elaborate a little bit on this terminology. Now, when you listen to the interview and you know, there were terminology, things like quarter or half warrants in there. Why don't we take the opportunity to explain that, Eric, in terms of what Marin meant by all of this?
Sure. You know, he does this stuff all day long, so I think he uses some of the terminology without realizing it's not completely familiar to everyone. But in the private placement market, which is only available to accredited investors, where you're buying shares in a company before the company goes public, usually, and as Marin described, there are also scenarios of private placements occurring with a small public company, which already has a public offering but wants to place more shares. So basically, the way these deals work is you're buying the stock, and they want you to buy the stock for what they think the stock is worth. And they don't want to discount the stock very much, because if they discount the stock to you, it sets a precedent in the market. So the way they create a sweet deal for accredited investors to make it worth their while to finance the early stages of a company's development, is they say, look, pay us full price, no steep discounts for the stock, and we'll give you this call option, which is called a warrant when it's issued by the company, and we'll give it to you effectively for free. Now, if you get a warrant that allows you to buy a share of stock through the warrant for every single share of stock that you buy, that's called a full warrant. In other words, it's a one-to-one relationship. A half warrant is where you get a warrant that allows you to buy one share of stock for every two shares that you bought. A quarter warrant is where you get a warrant allowing you to buy one share for every four shares that you actually bought for cash. So it's just a question of what the ratio is to this incentive of an option. And Patrick, the way that this usually gets presented to the company's management and the way that they get sold in this is saying, look, you're going to sell the stock. You're giving away this warrant, which is just a chance to sell more stock. You know, it's a good thing. Well, of course, in reality, it's optionality, which is what the investor is really getting. They don't have to lay down any more money for the stock. They lock in that early price, which means if the company is successful, they can buy that stock at the pre-IPO price, even years after the company has gone public, and just get an incredible deal. If the company doesn't take off and isn't successful, they never exercise the warrant. They're not out a penny. So it works out as a really good deal for all parties involved. The thing is, what everybody has done, what the most astute investors have done over the years, is they've said, okay, what I'll do is I'll sell the stock in order to get my original investment back. So I lock in a break even and I can't lose money. And then I'll just hang on to the warrant and I'll use that to experience whatever upside I'm going to experience. Marin's idea that he described in this interview, is the first time I'd ever heard of it, is absolutely brilliant. Persuade an exchange to list those warrants so that you can cash out of the warrants, get your break even so that you're sure that you can't possibly lose on the investment. Now what you can ride and hold on to is the stock that has no expiration date, and your effective cost of entry is zero because you already got your money back by selling the warrants. So it's an absolutely brilliant strategy that allows you to take a warrant-based strategy that most people use of peeling off the equity. That means you're stuck with whatever the expiration date is of the warrant. The way that Marin is doing it, he is selling the warrant when it still has a lot of time value in it. He's getting that premium back at a time when it's selling for more, and he's using the stock, which has no expiration date, to carry the longer term profit play forward indefinitely. Absolutely brilliant stuff. And so I love the way that Marin thinks.
And just as a note to those listeners that are interested in Marin's products, do not pay the $3,500 retail price that's on his website. The Macro Voice listeners are getting a discount of $1,500 off that, which is that $1,999. And so make sure you use the link that we included in the Research Roundup email if you choose to subscribe to Marin's work. Nonetheless, Eric, I want to move on. I want to touch on Marko Kolanovic because back in October of 2017, originally Marko Kolanovic at JP Morgan, who's their global head of macro quantitative and derivative strategy, essentially wrote a piece about what he coins as the next great crisis, which is a great liquidity crisis. And we talked about it back at that show. And he just recently published an update to that. And it just is so important to highlight the risks that he discusses in this report. And I just feel like we have to go back and revisit this now that he's published this. And the whole narrative here is that the entire marketplace, the structure of the marketplace has changed and created a whole series of new risks that just didn't exist in 2008 during the last financial crisis. And so I want to kind of go through each one of the highlighted points that he makes just so that we can discuss them. And if one of the biggest points that he makes is the shift from active to passive investing, where now he estimates close to 90% of trading volume comes from quants, indexing, ETFs and options trading, which are really at this moment means that there's very little counterparty to a lot of the systematic selling. And so he really highlights that this has dynamically changed, including the fact that now over $2 trillion has rotated from this active and value investing to passive and momentum strategies. In his mind, this eliminates a large pool of assets that would be standing by ready to buy all these cheap public securities to backstop the market. Basically, if the market was to have an event, the selling would just overwhelm anyone that's sitting on the sideline waiting to buy the dip. What's your take on that?
Well, this is so critically important, Patrick. And I think in general, before we even get into that point, this piece in general is really excellent, really timely. And his idea or his thesis of a great liquidity crisis being mostly liquidity driven as the next thing that happens in the market is really essential. The thing that I was most affected by this reading this article, as he says very clearly, that, you know, the great liquidity crisis is what the next one's going to look like. He makes an excellent argument for it, but he goes on himself and says, but hang on a second, folks, when all of the signs were there for the 2008 great financial crisis, it was around 2006 that the smartest guys in the room got wind of it, figured out what was coming, and started predicting it. And, you know, what makes me think is it feels so much right now like, okay, finally, overdue, the top of this crazy bull market, the longest one in recorded history. Maybe it's finally in. You know what this feels exactly like to me, Patrick, is the summer of 2007, not 8, but 7. And I remember that summer extremely well because I was convinced that it was over. I didn't know how to trade futures very well at that point. I was just in the early stages of reinventing myself from software entrepreneur to full-time investor. And I bought a whole bunch of put options on the S&P, convinced that we were going to have a fall crash in the fall of 2007, exactly a year too early. And of course, what happened was the S&P put in a new high in October of 2007, and my options expired worthless. So there's a caution here that, you know, he's making an excellent prediction that something really, really ugly could be coming. And I just want to caution our listeners, it doesn't mean that it's time to short the market right now and that the sky is falling. He's really describing a excellent set of arguments for why in the next couple of years things could get really dicey. But Patrick, let's go back to the point you brought up of active versus passive investment. This is so incredibly important. And you know, for all of the people that you'll encounter, as soon as you talk about active investment, they'll roll their eyes and say, well, they look at you very authoritatively and down their nose, they say, all of the data suggests very clearly that active just doesn't work and passive is better. Let's give credit to that argument, Patrick. Those people were right, and they were right about something which is inherently cyclical in its nature. The reason that active wasn't working is because at the time, the fad on Wall Street was active management, active management, active management. If everybody's doing it and all of the assets under management are in active strategies and everybody is trying to outsmart each other with a better active strategy, it's very, very hard for that to work. And that's the reason that index funds have become so popular. In an environment where everybody and his brother is in an active strategy, you're actually better off in a passive strategy. What those people seem to forget is it's a cycle. By the same token, when not just everybody and his brother, but everybody and his brother and every institution and every pension and everything under the sun is in ETFs and passive investment vehicles, that's when active has an opportunity to really shine, because you're not competing with every other asset manager under the sun trying to actively manage money using an active strategy. So I think that active is going to dramatically outshine passive in coming years. And it's not because one is better than the other. What makes active work is when the whole market is dedicated to passive strategies. Likewise, what makes passive strategies work is when the whole market is overallocated to active strategies. It's a cycle. The cycle has turned full circle, and it is time for passive to take an absolute beating in the next crisis, and the active management guys are the ones who are going to win. So I think that he's got it exactly right here, and you know, he goes into all kinds of detail about the degree of risk that exists in index ETFs and so forth. You know, the other guy that also has done a lot of fantastic work in this is Charlie McElligott. We got to get him on the program at some point too. In any case, I couldn't agree more with Kolanovic's view that the ETF situation creates a tremendous risk in this marketplace.
Well, you know, the one thing I'd comment there, like whether active outperforms passive or not, I don't know. I think that's a speculation to me. But what to me is the risk is that when you're talking about quants, when you're talking about index funds, when you're talking about ETFs, or even market makers running massive options books, taking the other side of all the hedging that is occurring in the options market, almost all of that selling is on autopilot. It's a very computerized, mechanical sell side. But if we ever had an event, and that's an if, because I don't want to say that I know it will happen, but if we ever had an event where all of these different systematic strategies are all getting the signals to sell, and they're all trying to run for the exit door, and the entire side of value investing and active management that usually backstops and provides the liquidity to buy to for those isn't there because it's just too small of a market versus the amount of liquidity pouring on the sell side, that could really throw the entire marketplace out of balance and cause a market event that is far steeper than it ever should have been on the other side. And that's a risk that, you know, hopefully we don't see, but unless, of course, you're heavily short, you don't mind profiting from something like that. But, you know, will that happen? It's definitely a risk that Marco Kolanovic is pointing out in this piece. So I encourage all of our listeners to actually read the piece that we had attached in the Research Roundup email.
Well, Patrick, that's exactly why I brought Charlie McElligott's name up, is if you look at what Kolanovic is saying, he's painting the big systemic macro picture here of why we're going to face a liquidity crisis and why these products are really offering a lot of risk. Who's the guy who's done the most analysis on what you just described, which is how once the selling starts, it becomes reinforcing and everybody's selling off? Charlie's done fantastic work on that. So we got to get him on the show at some point.
Okay, Eric, moving on, we do have an update for all of our listeners in regards to the videos from the Macro Voices Live. Why don't you share with everyone what's going on?
We are 99.44% of the way there, folks. We've got 3 of the 6 videos already edited. As we were recording on Thursday afternoon, our editor was in the process of rendering them. The way this is going to work, again, is if you've donated at least $50 in 2018 to Macro Voices, your account has already been coded for this. You just log in at macrovoices.com, and you should be able to access videos as they become available. Now, in your research Research Roundup email, you'll find a link to a trailer which gives a taste of this for anyone who didn't donate yet and wants to see what it's about. There are some little sample clips of some of the different presentations that are there. That's linked from the Research Roundup. For people who have made a donation and want to watch the videos, I want to say by the end of the day Friday, certainly by the end of the weekend at the latest, we'll have the first three videos up from the presentation. That would be Josh Steiner's presentation, Patrick's presentation, and my presentation. Meanwhile, Kevin Muir, Jeff Snyder, and Luke Groman, we're looking probably into the middle of next week sometime. But I would hope by the end of next week, we'll have all six videos, as well as probably what a lot of our listeners told us was the very best part of the event overall, which was our town meeting forum, where all of the participants asked questions. And we had all of the presenters on stage at the same time, in some cases disagreeing with one another. I hope by the end of next week we'll have all seven videos, which would be the six presentations plus the town meeting forum, up on the website for those of you who have donated. For those of you who want to get a taste of what it is, who aren't sure if you want to make that donation or not yet, just look in your Research Roundup email and you will find a link to the trailer that gives you a little taste of what's coming.
All right, well, moving on, Eric, last week we started toying with the idea of doing another live event. This one was clearly very successful, and maybe we're on to something. So I know that we discussed this a little further between us, and so why don't you also give an update to our listeners what we're thinking?
You know, this is really a story, Patrick, of just how amazing the Macro Voices community truly is. What I said last week is, you know, we're struggling here because we'd really like to do something, but we don't want to do a half-assed event. And I've talked to a professional event planner who could help us, who told me politely that we're just not big enough and he would cost too much and it wouldn't be practical. And, you know, I was kind of thinking, boy, what are we going to do? I don't know. The next day, I get an email from one of our regular listeners, George Gammon, saying, Eric, listen, I was in this business. What I did for a living was to produce large conferences. I know all about it. I retired in 2012. I've got some time on my hands. I want to help. I'll be happy to be your event planner for free. And I thought, free? I said, George, seriously? We talked on the phone. You know, you really, this is a lot of work. You want to do this totally for free as a volunteer? He said, absolutely. I love Macro Voices. I talk to my sister about it every single Friday. We do the Macro Voices recap on the phone, and I would love to help out. And I thought, wow, I'm not going to look this gift horse in the mouth. It'd be about once in 100 years that you get an offer like that. So we signed George up as our volunteer event coordinator to help us to produce the next big Macro Voices event. 48 hours later, that 100-year event happened again when Mike Meltzer, a regular listener in Baltimore, said, you're not going to believe this. My wife is a professional event planner, and we're willing to help for free. And I had to say, thank you so much, Mike and Kathy, his wife. But it turns out we've already got George on the case. So as we are speaking right now, recording the show on Thursday afternoon, Patrick, I believe that George and Kathy are having their first conference call to coordinate together and collaborate on designing the next event. And Patrick, George and I talked about this at length, and I am just passionate about this because, frankly, what we did in Toronto was we slapped something together very quickly as a test. We didn't know it was going to be anywhere close to as popular as it was. If we had known, we would have put more effort into it. What we're going to do for the next one is really put a lot of effort into taking the feedback that we've got from listeners, which is they value the idea of community and networking with other listeners and getting to know the speakers and the chance to meet them face to face as much as they value actually the formal sessions where you're listening to somebody on a stage make a presentation. So we're going to design the next event to be as community-oriented as possible. There's going to be a reception at the beginning so that there's an opportunity for networking and for the attendees to get to know one another. And we're looking at either a 2 or a 3 day format with quite a few more speakers. It'll be a much more professionally produced event than the first one. And what we're really excited about is there'll be two tiers. Kind of think of coach and first class on an airplane. The coach ticket will get you a chance to attend this conference and watch a whole bunch of fantastic speakers do their thing on stage. And it follows the format of a professional conference where it's basically about going to watch people on stage and then going home. We're going to do a VIP pass though. And for the coach class ticket, it's going to be a couple of lunches that'll be included. But for the most part, you're on your own. What we're going to do for the VIP pass is it'll be 3 meals a day, fully catered, excellent food. We're working on finding a place with excellent food. And you'll be eating your meals with the speakers, sharing the table with them. And the idea is when you sign up for the VIP pass, you will rank the speakers from 1 to 10 in terms of what your favorites are. And we will be organizing your breakfast, lunch, and dinner to put you at the same tables as all of your favorite speakers. And in addition to that, we're going to be doing some other things. There'll be VIP-only receptions with the speakers, so it's a smaller number of people to give everybody FaceTime with the speakers, as well as the opportunity to network with one another. So we're really putting a lot of thought into this. We haven't quite finished figuring it out yet. We think that probably the format will be 2.5 days for the main conference, and then there will be an extra half a day for the VIPs only, which will be some direct personal time with the speakers. So that's what we're working towards. George asked me to set up an alias, an email alias, which is events@macrovoices.com. If anybody has any suggestions or requests to go into how we design this, please let us know. I think George is probably not going to be able to respond to every single email that he receives, but I'm sure that he will be reading every single one of them. At the moment, what we're leaning towards is probably doing the event at a warm weather city in the United States in the wintertime, and we don't know any more specifically than that. Miami is probably off the table at this point because it's sold out. We're looking at Phoenix, Las Vegas, and Dallas at the moment. George is talking to all of the hotels in that city using his contacts to try to put something together. The timing would probably be around the 1st of February. We don't know exactly, but that's what we're working on, and we really want your feedback. Now, we already did a survey that went out to the attendees who were there in Toronto. We may do another survey to the entire Macro Voices community to get your feedback on what you want this to be. But we're trying to create something really special that is completely unlike anything else in the industry, where all of the speakers are people that you want to see. They're not people that paid for the opportunity to get some stage time. And we're actually setting things up, if you buy the VIP pass, so that you get personal one-on-one FaceTime with the speakers and with the other VIPs. So that's the strategy that we're working towards. It's still formative, but we're really excited about it.
Now, Eric, we had a lot of attendees that were actually from Vancouver and the West Coast, and we started setting an expectation that we'd probably do something out on the West Coast, maybe in Vancouver. What do we have in store for them?
Well, at this point, I think that George and I agree that the best place to do a Macro Voices live event is going to be in a warm U.S. city. The idea of going to Canada in January for a finance conference, when a lot of people were coming to the last one from the States and other places, really just doesn't make a lot of sense. The other thing is Vancouver is sold out in January because of all the skiers that are making their way up to Whistler. So it didn't really make sense to do that. But we also feel a certain obligation to the community that we have in Vancouver. So I had a fantastic conversation off the air with Marin Katusa. Now, Marin runs a fantastic natural resource investment conference in Vancouver every year. It's the entire Vancouver Convention Center. Something like 9,000 people attend this thing. It's a really, really big conference with a lot of fantastic speakers. Patrick and I have been invited to speak at that event. When I told Marin of our woes, that we really had decided that it made more sense to do the next Macro Voices event in the United States, but we'd already set an expectation with our friends in Vancouver, Marin is just a super guy. He said, look, come on down to our conference. You are welcome. You and Patrick can speak at the conference. We can have a little macro track if you want to, maybe do a macro panel as part of the conference. I want your audience to feel welcome at my event, and feel free to just ride on my coattails if that helps you to give something. So what I would say to Macro Voices fans who are either in Vancouver or interested in traveling to Vancouver January 20th and 21st for the Natural Resource Conference, which is outstanding, by the way, don't buy your ticket from the main website. Hold on. What we're working with Marin on is to bundle something where you'll get a ticket to the Natural Resource Conference, which is only $79. We'll probably mark that up to $89 or $99. That extra $20 will get you a ticket to go to a Macro Voices reception, probably at a restaurant, which will be more the Macro Voices party. It's not going to be presentations and so forth. Marin has already invited us to do some macro presentations as part of the Natural Resource Conference. And what we'll do is we'll just create a Macro Voices party, a reception and gathering for our Macro Voices listeners. A lot of the feedback that we got in Toronto is that people wanted to meet one another and network with other listeners. We'll find a way to set that up, or at least we hope to, in Vancouver in conjunction with the Natural Resources Investment Conference that's there January 20th to 21st. It won't be a Macro Voices conference. It'll be a Macro Voices party at Marin's conference. The Macro Voices conference, which is going to be our grand event, the event of the season, is probably going to be at a warm weather city in the United States sometime in the winter. But Patrick, we are way past out of time, and this has been a very long episode, but I hope a very worthwhile one. This interview with Marin was one of my favorites in terms of interviews that we've done to date. I think Marin is really just on top of his marketplace. We need your help, folks. Please tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, forward your research roundups, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. It doesn't cost you anything. It only takes a minute. We promise not to spam you or sell your email address. And the benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of all of the coolest stuff that we could find for free on the internet each week, including things that support our feature presentations. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find a transcript for today's interview with Marin. You're also going to find that link for more information about subscribing to Catoosa Research. There's also a link to that Marco Kolonovic article we discussed on the great liquidity crisis, and as well an actual interesting article from Variant Perception on their blog about China losing its edge on exports. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that blog or write about the markets and would like to share their content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com. the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors.
Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.